The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "Their Money is Being Taken Hostage. Greg Lindberg's insurance web has left many policyholders without access to their money." And the story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, "Death is the Only Way Out of This Product. How Greg Lindberg's insurance web, cloaked in a bribery scandal, could financially ruin many lives." Written by Lauren Onosorge. Daryl Ferguson is no gambler. Now in his 70s, Ferguson ran an auto shop in Terrell, Texas for years. He worked hard for every penny, and when he lost money on the stock exchange, he started to look for safer ways to invest the retirement savings he had left. His advisor recommended a 7-year annuity at 4.3% interest. The money would just sit there, Ferguson recalls. He funneled in $240,000 in 2018. "Almost all I had," he says, investing in an annuity held by a company called Colorado Bankers. Ferguson had never heard of Greg Lindberg, the North Carolina man at the reins of Colorado Bankers and multiple other insurance companies under the Eli Global umbrella. When Lindberg was arrested and later convicted in a political bribery scandal, Ferguson still didn't know his name. It wasn't until his wife became bedridden and he tried to pull out his cash to pay medical bills that the name Lindberg entered his world. "They wouldn't give it to me," he says of his life savings, "because of some guy in jail." Phyllis and Les Christos had also never heard of Lindberg when they, through Massachusetts-based Citizens Bank, invested more than $400,000 of their savings into an annuity. They claimed they were told their money would be safe, covered by the state's guarantee association that protects policyholders. But when Lindberg's headlines hit and they asked regulators, they were told that if the companies go under, just $250,000 of their savings will be protected. "It's just sickening," says Les Christos, a retired city worker for Boston who used savings and the proceeds from an inherited real estate sale to invest. "There's no way we'll be able to save this much money." "It's a lot of money for somebody like us," Phyllis Christos says. "We are just regular people who have been working our whole lives." Citizens Bank, which sold several annuities tied to Lindberg, did not comment for this story. But the reality is that 3 years after regulators took over Lindberg's companies, policyholders are no closer to seeing a dime of their retirements, and they're tired of waiting. Regulators blame Lindberg and have filed multiple lawsuits. Lindberg blames regulators, his attorneys claiming the companies could be out of debt in less than 12 months if only their client can keep control. But as the situation plays out in multiple courtrooms, policy surrender periods are ending, and clients across the country counting on that money to retire are kept waiting as Lindberg serves a prison sentence in Alabama. Regulatory limbo. Lindberg founded Eli Global, currently called Global Growth Holdings, in Durham in 1991, and over the years he began collecting insurance companies under the Eli Global umbrella, building a fortune as he went from a mansion at Raleigh's Falls Lake to a luxury yacht called the Double Down. The native Californian, once one of North Carolina's leading Republican donors, called himself a contrarian. In an interview in 2018, he said he built a company of scrappy, self-aware leaders who think long-term and are fearless of failure. Lindberg would stress the firm's humble roots repeatedly, both in his frequent leadership blogs and on the Global Growth website, how Eli Global started as a one-room business with 8 employees. He would later write that it began with a folding table and $5,000. Over the years, it would become an empire, a portfolio of more than 100 companies and 8,000 employees across 16 countries. But it's the insurance firms he started to collect that would threaten to bring that growth to a screeching halt. Specifically, it's the funds from those companies and Lindberg's practice of investing the cash into other businesses. It's a common practice in how insurance firms make their money, but typically insurance firms are prohibited from investing more than 10% of those assets, a regulatory stopgap meant to protect policyholders. Lindberg, however, found a loophole in North Carolina that, for a while, allowed him to invest well past that cap, more than 60% in the case of Southland. National Insurance Corporation. Sentiment shifted, however, with the new insurance commissioner. Fresh on the job in 2017, North Carolina Department of Insurance, or NCDOI, Commissioner Mike Causey discovered what was happening and, according to interviews and trial testimony, began investigating the practice. Lindbergh, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, claimed during his 2020 criminal trial, tried to bribe Causey to his way of thinking with campaign contributions. But instead of going along with the plan, Causey wore a wire and worked with the FBI as it built its case against Lindbergh. In the years since the case was made public, the state changed its policy, meaning companies can no longer exceed that 10% cap. But for Colorado Bankers and Southland National, the damage was already done. The insurance firms were deemed insolvent and put under the purview of Causey and the commission. As they worked to right the ship, they froze payouts, cutting off policyholders' access to most funds. But it's not an easy switch to turn back on, as regulators have said repeatedly in filings that without the money Lindbergh purportedly invested into other firms, the companies will remain insolvent. Ferguson and the Christos couple didn't know the details, nor do they care about the minutiae of insurance law. We just want our money, Phyllis Christos says. She's not alone. Filings in civil litigation against Lindbergh and his companies estimate more than $1 billion in insurance assets was invested in Lindbergh's other companies, amounting to a ton of policyholder money. What happens to the money? There are options, but none are easy or fast. Justin Holbrook, CEO of Global Growth, says rehabilitating the insurance companies are currently the firm's top priority. In 2022, Global Growth's highest strategic priority is to help our policyholders access their benefits this year by working with the North Carolina Department of Insurance to immediately rehabilitate the North Carolina insurance companies. Global Growth looks forward to making that roadmap public in the near future so we can bring this matter to a quick and decisive conclusion, Holbrook says. Meanwhile, if the courts move toward liquidating Lindbergh's insurance companies, the state's guarantee association would kick in and distribute at least a part of the invested dollars to annuity holders. Every state has what's called a guarantee association, which in the states of Texas and Massachusetts insures up to $250,000 in cases of annuities, meaning Ferguson would be fully protected, but Les and Phyllis Christos invested over that cap, based, they allege, on bad advice. Liquidating may be the only way Ferguson would get his money back anytime soon, but it would also likely put nearly half of the Christos' savings out of reach forever. But guarantee associations only come into play in cases of liquidation, and that hasn't happened, as the companies are embroiled in several lawsuits. Instead, the firms are inching along in what's called rehabilitation, similar to a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The companies, including Colorado Bankers, have been under the purview of the NCDOI, thousands of miles away from many policyholders, for 3 years. Bill O'Sullivan, Senior Vice President and General Counsel for the National Organization of Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Associations, explains guarantee associations as entities formed under state law for the purpose of protecting policyholders when an insurance company fails and can't meet its obligations. But to fail, a company has to be declared insolvent in court. A judge has to place it under what's called liquidation. Without that trigger, guarantee associations are not statutorily obligated to sweep in, leaving policies in limbo. Add in that moratorium order in the case of Lindbergh's companies that prohibits policyholders from surrendering their contracts or seeking cash withdrawals except for certain situations while under rehabilitation, and it's a problem. We've spoken to some policyholders, O'Sullivan says. In these types of situations, historically, people have some concerns. Policyholders aren't the only ones feeling the sting. Brokers see their businesses ruined. Max McMullen, who owned Alabama insurance seller Benefits for America, saw his retirement dissipate completely. He estimates Colorado Bankers owes him in excess of $300,000 in unpaid commissions. His clients came out more favorably, as most just had thousands of dollars in specialized life insurance policies, and much of that money was released. But McMullen has had to add side hustles, such as a startup call center, to keep cash coming, as about 90% of his business used to be with Colorado Bankers. "I never thought in my early 60s I would be starting over from scratch," McMullen says. "We have not made it back to where we were before, but we're trying." Ted Vahovias owns Medicare Supplements Plus, the Texas firm that sold Ferguson and many others the policies. He says the reputation hit has been devastating. His firm does not advertise, instead relying on word-of-mouth referrals, and clients are angry. "I have been servicing the state of Alabama employees for 27 years, and this has really put a dent, a blemish on my record," he says. It's disheartening that the Department of Insurance is taking this long to free up small amounts of money. This isn't really a lot of money. Vahuvius, who says a significant amount of his retirement is also wrapped up in frozen annuities, said NCDOI needs to just rip off the Band-Aid and liquidate so policyholders are protected. Their money is being taken hostage, he says. What do you tell these people? Regulators have few options. NCDOI says its hands are tied. Barry Smith, Assistant Director of Public Affairs, says that a court order bars it from making cash surrenders, transfers, and loans. While annuity holders reaching full maturity are being paid, the minutiae of how the policies work prevents people like Ferguson from getting payouts, even when their so-called surrender charge period ends, which for many policyholders is this summer. While some CBL annuities are approaching or have reached the end of their surrender charge period, this does not mean they are reaching maturity, he explains. The maturity date of an annuity is different from the end of the surrender charge period. The maturity date is normally the contract anniversary date in the year following the date that the annuity reaches maturity age, which is typically age 95. The surrender charge period is the time frame during which the owner cannot withdraw funds without incurring a surrender charge. The surrender charge typically is 3 to 7 years after purchase of the annuity. At the end of that surrender period, the guaranteed interest crediting rates drop from a range of 2.4% to 4.1%, all the way down to 1% to 1.65%. Smith says there's a hardship process, but that it is not designed to allow unrestricted access to funds. Clients say the agency has been slow to return their calls and also slow to return money that is actually due even under rehabilitation, such as life insurance payouts. In one case, a family had to borrow money from a funeral home, and instead of taking days to get their money, it took 3 months. Smith doesn't comment on individual situations. The problem is widespread, as policies held under the rehabilitation order were sold across the nation. This is going to destroy an industry, theorizes Ted Vahuvius' son, who also works at the Texas firm that sold Ferguson his policy. There are not a lot of places our seniors can go to invest. The inability of the system to deal with this company is a disaster. In very short order, a bunch of these contracts are going to come due, and if they don't fix this company, these people will not get their money, and their money will be trapped at a very minimal interest rate. Chet Vahuvius fears that if people know a state's insurance regulator could trap their money for just a 1% interest rate after their maturity date, brokers like him would not be able to sell future policies. Death is the only way out of this product, he says. But the calls keep coming, like the 85-year-old planning on what to do with his money when it matures in July, and the 70-something whose wife just died. With the bulk of the policies Vahuvius sold set to reach their surrender charge periods in the next year, the calls will likely increase, he says. Charles Matter, 87, sees his policy mature in June. He says he was counting on his insurance agent to work it out. But there's nothing that agent, Ted Vahuvius, can do, as Matter's money, like those of many others, is being held pending the rehabilitation. We can't do anything about it, Matter says. We're just plain old people. He declines further comment. While Commissioner Causey was not made available for this story, he did say in 2019 that policyholders will be protected, though he did not give a timeline. He pointed to the state's insurance guarantee fund that protects policyholders up to $300,000 in North Carolina. For those people who may have more than $300,000, I would just say, don't worry, don't panic, he said then. Let's let things play out. This is a long-term process, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that the policyholders are well protected. But 3 years later, that long-term process is starting to grate on policyholders who are still waiting. For those who invested several hundreds of thousands of dollars into the annuity policies, litigation, like the case currently working its way through Wake County Superior Court, may be their only chance at recouping their investments. But even a victory may not fully compensate policyholders if the money isn't there. Victory for plaintiffs. Plaintiffs got a big win in May when Judge Graham Shirley ruled that Lindbergh should relinquish control of the insurance firms to an independent panel, which could then sell off the assets to pay back policyholders. But Lindbergh's attorneys have pushed back. Within days of the order, they filed a motion to stay its enforcement, which was promptly denied. Attorney Aaron Tobin says Lindbergh plans to appeal, a delaying tactic, West Camden, the Williams-Mullen attorney representing the insurance companies, has said. Camden and other attorneys have accused Lindbergh of flat-out stealing policyholder money. After filing an additional lawsuit over millions in tax refunds he claims are owed to the insurance companies, Camden said, "We have a name for when you take someone else's money and won't pay it back. Stealing." Lindbergh attorneys characterize it differently in their statements, filings, and arguments. In court May 26, Tobin told the judge that if Lindbergh could keep control of the companies, they could be solvent as early as next year, something Camden says he has seen no evidence to support. In an email, Tobin says the rehabilitators have been in place for 3 years and have not proposed a single transaction to benefit the policyholders. Instead, they have filed over 30 lawsuits and paid themselves and their lawyers millions of policyholder dollars, Tobin says. Companies under Lindbergh have paid insurers more than $370 million over that time period, he says. In court, Camden said Lindbergh's team should not get credit for paying down debts they purportedly created. "It's not a hero's tale to pay your loan back," Camden told the court in a hearing May 26 in Wake County. Colorado Banker status. Colorado Bankers is one of multiple Lindbergh-affiliated insurance firms deemed insolvent and placed under rehabilitation in 2019. Southland National Insurance Corporation, Bankers Life Insurance Corporation, or Company, Colorado Bankers Life Insurance Company, and Southland National Reinsurance Corporation are all under the state order of rehabilitation and filing show little improvement. The last quarterly report published in November for the September quarter shows that Southland National alone had $177 million in affiliated investments at 69% of its assets. Colorado Bankers had $961 million in affiliated investments, 40% of its assets. That's all money unavailable to policyholders. In the meantime, all policyholders can do is wait. Ferguson said he never expected to struggle to pay bills at age 76 after a lifetime of saving his dollars, but he's a realist. "There's a good possibility that you're going to lose the invested dollars," Ferguson says to himself. "If you don't lose, you may die before you lose. If I die, my wife can go ahead and get what's there without penalty, but not unless I die." In the Boston suburbs, Les Christos isn't sure what happens next. "I can't even drive by Citizens without feeling sick," he says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. One-bedroom units are popular now. Years ago, you stumbled out of college, grabbed a job, and snagged a two-bedroom apartment with a roommate as you powered into your career, but that dynamic is changing as a new apartment building in downtown Raleigh demonstrates. Taft Family Ventures of Greenville plans a 12-story building with 261 units at the corner of Cabarrus and Dawson Streets. The design by J. Davis Architects includes a whopping 193 one-bedroom units and only 68 two-bedroom units. It's a trend you see in urban areas such as Chicago, sleek towers with smaller living spaces but plenty of community space such as elevated pools and large swank common areas. Bill Egan, housing director for J. Davis, notes that this trend towards smaller space but more amenities is not just Gen Zers. We're also seeing empty nesters making similar decisions in pursuit of a more pedestrian-oriented life. According to Houston-based ApartmentData.com, there are still more two-bedroom apartments across the Greater Triangle than others, with 77,354 two-bedroom units, 63,397 one-bedrooms, 17,976 three-bedrooms, and 4,319 efficiencies. But ApartmentData.com analyst Bruce McClenney says interest in one-bedrooms has surged since the Great Recession, in part because developers can get a higher rate per square foot on one-bedrooms and thus squeeze more dollars out of the space. And that's vital in areas such as downtown Raleigh, where the price of dirt is high. "They were challenged to try to find ways to get back in the game and start developing, and all of a sudden we started to see a high number of one-bedroom units, higher than we had seen had been seeing prior to the Great Recession," McClenney says. "It was primarily to make the numbers work. I think they got lucky when millennials came around and were perfect for that setup, the smaller one-bedroom. It's not saying the product is not good. It's just a sign of the times, the cost of buying land, and the cost of development." Southern Pines, a hit for the open. Southern Pines rose in unison to applaud what many are now saying was one of the best performances, if not the best, by a woman golfer on the country's biggest golf stage. Australian Minji Lee set the all-time 72-hole scoring record on her way to winning the longest continuously played championship in women's golf, the U.S. Women's Open. Lee was 13 under at Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club. While tournament organizers acknowledged that the vast majority of fans drove to Southern Pines to watch the championships, executives were surprised at the sheer number of fans during the weekend, and that itself led some golfers to opine that Moore County may, in fact, be just a special place. Overall, this is probably some of the biggest crowds that I've seen at the U.S. Women's Open. This is a huge golfing community. It's actually nice to go to places where people love it. People are excited about women's golf being here. People are excited about golf in general, said golfer Lydia Ko, who finished among the top five in the tournament. Sequeris completes $156 million expansion. A company that develops and manufactures influenza vaccines has completed a $156 million expansion of its facility in Holly Springs. Sequeris announced June 6 the completion of the four-year project, which, along with a new pre-filled syringe line, will allow the company to enhance the site's ability to respond to an influenza pandemic. The expansion will also support more than 80 additional jobs. The company built its Holly Springs facility through a partnership established with the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority in 2009. In March, the company and BARDA renewed an agreement that would require Sequeris to produce up to 150 million vaccine doses within 6 months of a declared influenza pandemic. Triangle Towns lead growth. Carolina Demography over in Chapel Hill has crunched some U.S. Census data that details how dramatically the small towns in the Triangle are growing. Leading the state in percentage growth from 2020 to 21 is Wendell, which exploded in population by 18.1%, and second was Zebulon at 15.3%. What's driving that, of course, is that land is cheaper in those areas closer to Raleigh, allowing for more affordable homes, but the top 15 fastest-growing communities included many more triangle towns, such as number 7, Anger, 7.8%, number 8, Fuquay-Varina, 7.6%, number 10, Clayton, 7.5%, number 11, Apex, 7%, number 14, Four Oaks, 6.2%, and number 15, Rollsville, 6%. And finally, debutante ball takes to a tent. The 2021 state debutante ball, delayed from September by COVID, had a unique feel when it was held June 4. Raleigh's Terpsichorean Club has hosted the Deb Ball since 1926, and the formal presentations are usually downtown. But facing scheduling conflicts, the Terp shifted to a unique event that preserved its formal grandness and yet had a fresh and lively feel for a celebration of young women who had their high school graduations and college beginnings whacked by COVID. On this night, the Debs were presented in a massive tent on the club lawn before a rousing party inside. Biz hears the weekend was a huge success with grateful grandparents, sumptuous flowers, and an epic performance by the Atlanta Showstoppers Band to end the night. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the continuing 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Organically Diverse in Embracing DEI, IT firm WorkSmart is focusing on building its team based on individual merit without visibility to gender, race, or personal demographics. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. One of the largest minority-owned companies in the Triangle doesn't spend a lot of time talking about diversity and inclusion, but that doesn't mean equity and doing right by their communities isn't a top priority. Clay Harris, president and CEO of WorkSmart, describes the company culture as embracing of diversity, not just tolerant of diversity. WorkSmart, founded in 2001 by Chairman Ron Unger, whose heritage is in part Native Alaskan, is also co-owned by Chief Financial Officer Ricky Ayers, who is black, and Harris, who is white. We're lucky to have started in Durham and to have expanded the business to progressive areas. Charlotte and Atlanta are proudly diverse communities. And when you have that fabric, we have the luxury of recruiting people from a candidate pool that is diverse, Harris says. The diversity across their 120-person team has been accomplished organically as opposed to strategically, and in the male-dominated IT and computer industry, WorkSmart boasts an overall gender diversity of 30% female. Among the company's management, 39% of the leadership identifies female. The way Harris might choose to address bias in hiring is the opposite of what many people say. Individuals from underrepresented communities often express a desire to work where they see someone who looks like me, and many companies set quotas to achieve a more diverse balance. WorkSmart looks to hire on merit, preferably without knowing a candidate's minority status. Harris's ideal hiring strategy is to eliminate any visibility into the personal characteristics of potential candidates. One of the things we've kicked around, especially in the recruiting process, is how can we look at resumes without names? I would love to get to a point where I'm just looking at experience and skills without seeing anything that would possibly introduce bias from a person's name or location, Harris says. The applicant tracking systems that have options for pictures, video resumes, or social media profiles don't appeal to him. Instead, he'd prefer that his recruiters were legitimately just looking at what the person has done, what their experience is, and how that experience would fit in here. It's an approach that might produce more inclusive results, especially when a snapshot of his team reveals that not only are a third of the staff women, but also the associates exhibit representation across people of color as well as a span of generations. By contrast, the majority of professionals working in IT or computer fields are male, and the largest racial demographic is white. In fact, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as of 2021, more than 72% of the people in professional IT roles are white, including those employed in computer and information system management, information security and computer support, database administration and architecture, computer system administration, and computer network architecture. Women make up less than 20% of the tech workforce across jobs in information security analysis, computer programming, network and computer system administration, and computer network architecture. In its 2022 State of Technology report, the North Carolina Technology Association, or NCTA, found that people of color are underrepresented in the tech industry compared to the state's general population, and North Carolina falls below the national average, ranking 22nd in the nation for diversity in tech employment. Similarly, NCTA reported women account for one-third of tech occupations, but one-half of the state's population, although North Carolina has higher rates of women working in the tech industry compared to other states. Tech employers know they need to increase diversity, not only in their employees, but in the leadership in their companies, says Andrea Fleming, Director of Talent and Workforce Development at NCTA. From our recent diversity benchmark initiative, most already have programs, training, and employer resources groups underway. This is progress. In embracing diversity, Harris says they want to help their associates gain better perspectives on other people's experiences. Within the past year, they've encouraged team members to display their preferred pronouns in communication. It's a subtle way of respecting differences, one that has been overwhelmingly well received, he said, noting that including preferred pronouns is an opt-in choice, not an expectation of employees. I don't understand what it would be like for someone to misgender me, but I know we want to make sure all of our team members feel safe and welcomed. We want people here to reach their full potential. That really matters to me and to our leadership team. We want everyone to be who they're meant to be. Demand for their business grew during the pandemic, with company revenue increasing from $18 million in 2020 to $21 million in 2021. Their clients are small and medium-sized businesses with fewer than 100 employees and mostly located in the Carolinas or Georgia. We're pretty industry agnostic, and in the different places where we're located, there are different concentrations of business. Durham has a lot of life sciences companies and a lot of professional services companies. In the southwest part of Charlotte, it's more light industrial businesses. And in Alpharetta, an Atlanta suburb, there are a lot of nonprofits and professional services, Harris says. The transition to work from home, literally to work from anywhere, has created a tidal wave of demand for IT support with an emphasis on security needs and cloud services. The vast majority, like 90% of what we do for our clients, is the same across the board, he says. But regardless of the industry, the last 10% is what really makes a difference, and that's the bespoke part. That 10% is what requires a real relationship with an understanding of what the client needs and what they define success to be. Supply chain disruptions that are impacting every business are also having a significant impact on WorkSmart. It's hitting us hard. Even things like docking stations or wireless exit points are hard to come by. And when one thing is missing, it ripples across and creates other problems. That's the most frustrating thing right now. The company grew dramatically last year, adding 15 team members through acquisition of two Georgia-based businesses, RMS Associates and Land Systems, and another 15 associates through organic growth. WorkSmart's niche market is small businesses, including startups. The psychology of the client is more important to us than the size of their business. We've had a client who was literally one person, Harris says, adding IT needs to be part of their client strategy, not purely transactional. And we have two short news articles in the 52 Shades of Success section. USDA pledges $1.92 million to North Carolina HBCU to aid innovation. On June 8, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a $1.92 million investment to establish an Agriculture Business Innovation Center at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical, NCA&T, State University, a historically black college and university, HBCU, located in Greensboro. This new innovation center will serve as a technical assistance hub to enhance agriculture-based business development opportunities nationwide, said USDA Deputy Secretary Jewel Branagh during a two-day strategy meeting with 1890 land-grant universities and USDA officials. This latest investment will expand the capacity of our nation's HBCUs to advance multidisciplinary teaching, outreach, and integrated projects to build better markets, enhance economic development, and support new and existing agricultural businesses. This new innovation center is a perfect complement to the NIFA-funded 1890 Center of Excellence for Student Success and Workforce Development already housed at NCA&T State University, said Acting NIFA Director Dion Toombs. Raleigh to celebrate Juneteenth over several days. A number of events marking the Emancipation Holiday will be held across Raleigh beginning on June 15 with an online launch of the Juneteenth celebration hosted by the North Carolina Museum of History. Additional events will be hosted by the museum leading up to day-long events on June 18 at the State Capitol and the Harvey Hill Field. Tours at the State Capitol will be held from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and will honor the stories of enslaved African Americans who constructed the building. From 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., there will be a variety of musical entertainment, guest speakers, and entertainment. The weekend celebrations culminate on June 19 at the historic St. Paul AME Church. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. WakeMed, key insurer reach an impasse. Patients impacted as United Healthcare WakeMed talks fail. WakeMed Health and Hospitals is no longer in the network of one of the country's largest health insurers after the two sides failed to reach an agreement on a new contract. As of June 1, WakeMed's hospitals, outpatient clinics, and physician specialists are no longer considered in-network for United Healthcare, although WakeMed's primary care physicians are unaffected, and patients under United Healthcare may still receive treatment at any of the healthcare system's emergency departments. The change means thousands of WakeMed patients will pay more for care and could face hurdles getting access to treatment. The two sides describe different reasons for their inability to agree on a new contract. In a statement, WakeMed said the two sides have worked on a new deal for nearly a year, but have been unable to agree on language on United Healthcare's coverage policies. The healthcare system has said that last year United Healthcare denied reimbursement for medical care to WakeMed patients significantly more than any other insurance company. Contract language regarding fair payment practices, particularly as it relates to medical necessity, has been the primary focus of our negotiations, WakeMed said. To date, WakeMed has not addressed any rate proposals because we must first have contractual language that is more acceptable. United Healthcare has pushed back on this assertion. According to the company, about 90% of the claims that WakeMed submitted to the insurer over the last year were approved. Of the remaining 10%, the majority were denied because of an administrative error by WakeMed. The Minnesota-based insurer says WakeMed refused to discuss rates during the negotiations after proposing a 20% increase in prices last year. UnitedHealthcare said that would have increased premiums and out-of-pocket costs for 20,000 customers. The insurer added that in April it proposed the two sides extend the previous contract to provide additional time to negotiate a new deal, which WakeMed rejected. "We've made numerous attempts to compromise and find solutions as part of good faith negotiations," UnitedHealthcare said in a statement. "Unfortunately, WakeMed chose to cancel our contract, declined our offer to extend our current agreement, and never countered the multiple rates proposals we've provided since December." Medical device company buys Parata Systems for $1.53 billion. A multinational company with revenue topping $20 billion is acquiring a Durham-based firm focused on automation solutions for the pharmacy industry. Becton Dickinson & Company, a medical technology company with operations in Research Triangle Park, announced June 6 it has entered into an agreement to purchase Parata Systems from Fraser Healthcare Partners. The all-cash transaction worth $1.525 billion is expected to close in the first half of Becton Dickinson's 2023 fiscal year. Becton Dickinson, headquartered in New Jersey and number 173 on the Fortune 500, said the deal will give it access to a $600 million pharmacy automation market that's estimated to reach $1.5 billion over the next decade. Parata provides pharmacy technology solutions to reduce costs, enhance patient safety, and improve the patient experience. Its pharmacy automation portfolio includes medication adherence packaging, high-speed robotic dispensing technologies, and pharmacy workflow solutions. Closed Garner facility seeks more bed. A few months after purchasing a psychiatric hospital in Garner that closed last year, a national behavioral health services provider wants to add more licensed beds to the facility. Summit BHC, based in Tennessee, submitted a Certificate of Need application to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services in May to add 60 inpatient psychiatric beds to the facility at 3200 Waterfield Drive. This would increase the total number of licensed beds at the facility from 56 to 116. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Leo Daughtry, member of the University of North Carolina System Board of Governors, on the legislature including in the last budget a requirement that the system move from Chapel Hill to downtown Raleigh. The budget allocated $15 million over 4 years to the UNC system to fund a short-term lease. "It is my opinion that the move from here to Raleigh was done purely on the basis of politics." And finally, we have a big number, $8 million. The amount Morrisville-based 10X Therapeutics recently raised through a deal with a single institutional investor focused on healthcare. The company, which is developing therapies that address cardiovascular and pulmonary diseases with high unmet needs, plans to use the funding to advance its clinical programs and for general corporate purposes. And now we turn to the On Tech and Travel page written by Lauren Onisorge. Triangle greets new unicorn, Jupiter One. Morrisville startup adds $70 million in planned staff expansion. Just 2 years in, and a Morrisville startup is already claiming unicorn status thanks to a $70 million raise, a $1 billion valuation, and according to its CEO, heads-down hustle. Jupiter One, a fast-growing cybersecurity firm led by Erkang Zhang, claims it earned the moniker held by companies valued at $1 billion or more. Firms such as Raleigh-based Pendo, Cary-based Epic Games, and Durham's Phononic. It crossed the threshold with a Series C round disclosed on June 2nd. Tribe Capital led the round with participation from new investors Intel Capital and Alpha Square Group. Existing investors Sapphire, Bain Capital, Cisco Investments, and Splunk Ventures also contributed to the raise. Zhang, who along with Jupiter One's employees maintains a very significant stake in the firm, calls the investor support validating, and it gives the company 3 to 4 years of runway, possibly to profitability, he says. "It just depends on how we execute and how we accelerate," Zhang says. At valuations this high, the exit rumors start to swirl, but Zhang says it's too early for IPO buzz. "After you cross this milestone, it is sort of natural and logical to think IPO sometime down the road," he says. sure, that absolutely is a possibility, but I still think it's too soon. We're focused heads down building the product. Jupiter One is doing something that nobody else is, he says. It's trying to create new cybersecurity standards with its cyber asset attack surface management platform. It crunches data to provide visibility into the company's entire cyber asset universe, and that's where the focus is, Zhang says. Everything else will just happen naturally, he adds. RDU's London flight resumes. Finally, after more than 2 years, the math works. An American Airlines nonstop flight to London is back at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. It's a comeback literally years in the making, and American Airlines executives are optimistic about how the flight will fare long term as bookings are up. RDU to London's Heathrow Airport is a key part of American Airlines network, says Jason Riesinger, the carrier's managing director of global network planning. He says the long-delayed flight, the only long-haul international route in the American Airlines system that leaves out of a non-hub airport, is just part of American's RDU comeback. IBM CEO wants more Red Hat savings, more Red Hat cost savings. IBM CEO Arvind Krishna told a crowd of analysts at the Bernstein 38th Annual Strategic Decisions Conference in New York that there's room for improvement at Big Blue, and that includes finding efficiencies with Raleigh-based Red Hat. Of Red Hat, the open-source software firm IBM acquired in 2019 for $34 billion, the cloud boost has met expectations, but there's room for more savings down the line, Krishna said. The plan is, over time, to merge more back-office functions, all while keeping the Red Hat neutrality. Policy Genius with Durham HQ slashes staff. Insurance technology firm Policy Genius has confirmed layoffs, and dozens of the impacted employees are in the triangle. Policy Genius CEO Jennifer Fitzgerald confirmed the news in a LinkedIn post, publishing a list of Policy Genius alumni that she said should be the first place to look if you're hiring. And finally, in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Ed Bastian, CEO of Delta Airlines, speaking at Bernstein's 38th Annual Strategic Decisions Conference in New York. Europe this summer is on fire. I encourage everyone to get their tickets booked because the demand is very, very strong. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Bramette. Raleigh ramps up plans for top hotel, city to add funds for a swank hotel near convention center. The city of Raleigh is moving forward with its goal to add a high-rise hotel to the downtown skyline and potentially a mixed-use tower. Earlier this year, the Raleigh City Council revived its plan for towers to be built on two city-owned lots at the south end of Fayetteville Street. The city is now planning a 500-room hotel that can serve conventions and a second tower of primarily residential space instead of office space. The city has released a request for information seeking developers interested in leading the project, which is fueled by a plan to expand the Raleigh Convention Center's operations. Jones Lang LaSalle is handling the RFI process on behalf of the city. Submissions are due August 19. The project continues a surge in interest in hotels in downtown Raleigh, a market that had suffered from a lack of top hotels in the past. The RFI is mainly focused on the hotel portion of the project, but could include the second tower as well if developers express interest in doing both. The city is offering an incentive of $30 million in public funding to be spent on parking and infrastructure assistance, though some flexibility for its use is possible. The available land spans 2.5 acres across from the Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts and is zoned for up to 40 stories of development. The city is planning to extend Fayetteville Street through the property, effectively splitting it into two sites measuring about 1 acre each. Listed in the RFI, the city wants the hotel to feature an upper upscale national brand name. The city's goals for the second tower include ground level retail, for sale and or for rent residential, office space, or other creative ideas. The RFI also mentions the desire for below grade parking spanning both sites. Following the RFI deadline, JLL, in partnership with the city, will evaluate the responses. The city will then engage a stakeholder team, likely in early summer, to develop recommendations for the city council. The city then might proceed to a request for proposals phase or begin negotiating with a developer. If an RFP phase is chosen, 2 to 4 lead developers will be invited to participate in the process. Kane Realty announces North Hills' first ABC store. Kane Realty is bringing major changes to North Hills, including the addition of new towers. Now the developer is adding an ABC store to the mix. An ABC store, the only retail shops allowed to sell liquor in North Carolina, will be opening in North Hills this fall. The store will be operated by the Wake County Board of Alcoholic Control and will be located on the main district shopping side of the development. The store will be situated between REI and a Bank of America branch. "We're thrilled to welcome the Wake County ABC store to North Hills," said Stacy Busher, Managing Director of Operations for Kane Realty. "Adding an ABC store to the tenant mix at North Hills has been requested for years from the surrounding community, so we're excited to finally make that happen." The Wake County Board of Alcoholic Control operates 25 retail stores. Accounting merger yields top 8 firm. A merger between two accounting firms is now complete, creating a top 10 outfit operating under a new name. Charlotte-based Dixon Hughes Goodman, or DHG, announced its merger with Missouri-based BKD in February, establishing a firm with over 5,000 employees across 68 markets. Forvis, the firm's new name, spelled F-O-R-V-I-S, says it now ranks as the number 8 professional services firm in the nation with an estimated revenue of $1.4 billion. The firm will maintain the former DHG offices in Charlotte, Raleigh, Pinehurst, Asheville, Hendersonville, High Point, Winston-Salem, and Greenville. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Courtney Moore, principal at EDSA, as the global landscape architecture firm moves into the Triangle with the creation of a Raleigh office. Moore and Michael Batts, two NC State University products, are leading the build-out. "By 11 a.m. yesterday morning, I had done work in Kentucky, Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, the Bahamas, and just north of Wilmington." And finally, a big number. $6.7 million. That was the direct economic impact for Wake County due to rapper J. Cole's Dreamville Festival held at Dorothea Dix Park in April. The music festival saw 80,000 attendees across its 2 days. Saturday night of the festival, Wake County's hotel occupancy rate reached 92%. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. First, we have a column written by Lori O'Keefe, who is the president and CEO of Triangle Community Foundation. The headline, "Finding Support for Capacity Building, Crucial for Nonprofits." During the summer of 2020, racial unrest permeated the nation following the murder of George Floyd. Outrage was not limited to just individuals. Organizations, too, felt the need to codify their support for the Black Lives Matter movement, as well as their assurance to be more inclusive. At the time, organizations pledged upward of $50 billion in support of racial justice. While we hope those same organizations have followed through with their commitments, at Triangle Community Foundation, we have intentionally prioritized organizations led by and serving people of color since 2014 through our work with the Triangle Capacity Building Network, or TCBN. TCBN began as a group of 5 Triangle funders: Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Foundation, John Rex Endowment, Oak Foundation, the Mary Duke Biddle Foundation, and Triangle Community Foundation, who came together out of concern to collaborate on better supporting the region's nonprofit sector following the seemingly sudden financial collapse of a local nonprofit. Fidelity Charitable joined us in 2020. Over the last 8 years, through our relationships with grantees, we have focused on active listening and shifting decision-making power to the community in response to real-time needs, particularly in light of the pandemic. Capacity building can have different meanings for different people, and even TCBN has redefined it amid COVID-19. For example, while back-office infrastructure remains a core aspect of building capacity, so too now is self-care. With so many nonprofits working tirelessly in support of communities, we must get creative to ensure sustainability of those same organizations. Recently, TCBN partnered with Microsoft and its Nonprofit Tech Acceleration Program to facilitate technology grants to nonprofits serving the Black community. Grantees work with technology specialists to design and implement the technical solutions that meet the needs of the organization. Similarly, Red Hat's Social Innovation Program offers consulting services to nonprofits on open source projects. While your organization may not be as large or have as many resources as Microsoft or Red Hat, I would like to challenge you to think about what ways you can provide services or assistance to nonprofits. Additional needs we hear about regularly from our grantees include finance and accounting, marketing, and as previously mentioned, and perhaps most of all lately, self-care. Importantly, however, as you think about ways your organization can help, it is important to consider the nuance involved in engaging with an organization looking to make social change, which likely operates very differently than a for-profit corporate model. Nonprofit partner William Jackson, founder of Village of Wisdom, shared that in his experience, organizations like Village of Wisdom are committed to not only doing liberatory work, but striving to create liberatory environments, which may feel different than the environments that corporate employees come from. Corporations that are looking to partner with organizations doing liberatory work should consider that they may not understand the organization's ethos or vision, so the posture of partnership should be as a learner. This means asking, what can we do to support your vision, instead of the more paternalistic, how can we advise you? And then being open to whatever the organization may say, even if their answer doesn't fit into the usual corporate volunteer program. The pandemic has changed individuals and organizations in ways big and small. Nonprofit organizations, particularly those serving people of color, have been disproportionately impacted, with many seeing double, if not triple, digit percent increases in individuals requesting their services. These organizations will never turn away anyone who needs their assistance, but to sustain themselves, organizations and the individuals who run them must be nurtured and cared for as well. How can your organization provide some of that much-needed support? And now we turn to a viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Economy Could Derail Relocations Expansions. On July 7, Target Corporation warned investors that it will take a short-term hit in profits as it has to move millions of dollars worth of merchandise by bringing down the prices and getting rid of its excess inventory. This is Target, one of America's favorite retail stores, and it has a problem. That news came just days after the nation's top two retailers, Amazon and Walmart, cited having too many workers on the payroll, resulting in lower profits and productivity. For Walmart, profits dropped about 25%, and for Amazon, productivity was off as costs increased by $2 billion in the latest quarter. As the Omicron variant subsided in the second half of the quarter and employees returned from leave, we quickly transitioned from being understaffed to being overstaffed, resulting in lower productivity, Amazon Chief Financial Officer Brian Olsavsky said. What this means is that the world's largest companies are trying to figure out the nitty-gritty of their operations to make sure they can survive these economic headwinds of higher inflation, drier capital markets, war, and continuing supply chain issues. So when states and communities get excited about companies making a big job announcement during these times, don't hold your breath. Electric vehicle producers such as VinFast, Toyota, Rivian, and Hyundai have all announced new plants in different states in the past year as consumers get tired of paying high prices at the gas pump and perhaps are seriously considering an EV for their next purchase. These companies all have estimated start dates when the first EV will come off the new plants. Maybe some will happen, but don't bet on it. Similarly, tech companies such as Apple, Google, Meta, and so many other companies have made giant expansion announcements in the past 2 years that have made communities jump up and down with joy, with governors, legislators, and business executives laying down the red carpet as if the answer to all the economic problems would soon be over. Again, don't bet on any of these deals being able to keep their initial deadlines. Why is that? Because economic conditions change, and if we believe that a company's management and its board have a fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders, any such large capital commitment at this time is simply not a sound business decision given the uncertainty. One could also question the timing of these large economic development announcements. Of course, 2022 is a big election year. What better way to garner votes from citizens than by offering them high-paying jobs, new roads, and a promise to address diversity, affordability, and inequality with its newest corporate partner? Having said that, there is little doubt many of these deals will get done because the largest U.S. companies are sitting on a pile of cash, $7.1 trillion to be exact. Many can afford to embark on these expansions or calm their shareholders by buying back company stock. And according to a recent Bank of America report, S&P 500 companies are still set on spending 20% more this year on capital expenditures when compared to last year. But there will be projects that will not happen, just like Foxconn in Wisconsin, Peloton in Ohio, and hundreds of smaller projects across the nation. Maybe now is the best time to, once again, refocus on the needs of companies that are already in communities and are vested in our residents. They can use all the help they can get. And now we turn to some nonprofit brief stories. Grants available to downtown Raleigh entities. Downtown Raleigh businesses looking for a lift can apply for storefront upfit grants provided by the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. The first deadline to submit an application is July 1. Up to three additional funding rounds are planned throughout the July to June fiscal year. Grants are available to reimburse new and expanding downtown storefront businesses for upfit expenses, i.e. construction-related items, and one-time stand-up expenses, for example, point-of-sale systems. The program offers reimbursements at tiers of up to $7,500, $5,000, and $2,500. Businesses that are 50% or more minority or women-owned may apply for an additional $2,500 in funding. The maximum funding available per eligible business is $10,000. Between 2020 and 2021, DRA awarded more than 100 grants totaling nearly $400,000 to small, locally owned businesses in downtown Raleigh. Hope, North Carolina gets grant from Social Work School. Hope, North Carolina, which seeks to build communities where people of all abilities and ages engage with one another, has been awarded up to $150,000 per year for 4 years and possibly five from the CARES program at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Social Work. The grant will accelerate Hope, North Carolina's work to identify and develop opportunities to create inclusive communities with a focus on increasing affordable and inclusive housing. Hope NC will be partnering with Alliance Health, CASA, and Partnership for Aging Program, UNC. Funding comes from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. This initiative will address areas of concern in building communities that are inclusive of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, physical disabilities, and older adults in North Carolina. And in our final seconds with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the Business Pulse survey. The question, should marijuana be legal in North Carolina? Total number of responses, 248. 75% say yes. 14% say medical use is fine, but not for recreational use. And 11% say no. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.